I have a couple of other questions, Angela, for you. If you could go backwards, you had some slides involving the 360 farms in the Salinas area and the number of pesticides that were in use. And I think you said there were a total of 75 pesticides in use that have been identified?
There are 75 pesticides which have been currently detected in surface water. Okay. We evaluated of the farms that apply pesticides. Are all of them using those 75, or are some growers using chemicals that are not even found in surface water?
So let's take away the two big ones, okay? Of the those 73, are any of those 73 having a toxic effect in surface waters?
Yes.
Okay. But you're not proposing to pull those into the same requirement as you are for chlorpyrifos and diazinon?
No, staff considered, as mentioned in the staff report, staff considered a wide variety of options for developing requirements related to toxicity and pesticide. As an example, we looked at DPR's entire list of restricted use chemicals, looked at which of those chemicals were detected in Central Coast water and which were in use, and still found that that list was very broad and felt that that would be overly burdensome to growers to apply a tiering criteria based upon the use of 75 chemicals. So that is why we looked at which chemicals were well documented to cause toxicity and impairment in water bodies in the Central Coast region. And at the time of the drafting of this order, there was significant evidence in the literature about chlorpyrifos and diazinon.
Okay. I think you said that the 73 do have a toxic effect in surface waters. Forgetting about that they're maybe not as much in use as the other two, I don't see how you're justifying not including them in this requirement.
It goes to reasonableness and also because of the overwhelming amount of information for these two. So that we just wanted to start off with the two known to cause severe toxicity and impairment in Central Coast region. In response to staff's own thinking about other chemicals that cause toxicity, as well as many, many comment letters about that, we included a finding in the draft order that specifies as additional information becomes available and impairments are known and it becomes documented of other chemicals, we may also include those or consider those as part of the tiering criteria.
And how is that information going to be known to staff?
Well, these studies are ongoing as to the toxicity of various pesticides in receiving waters. The Department of Pesticide Regulation has a draft report out. It just came out in February, which goes to this very subject. It is sampling that is above and beyond what has been done in the past, and it shows that there are other chemicals that are causing toxicity and that are found in receiving waters. And the report or the order, the way we've written it, allows the executive officer to take into account this new information that comes up and change the criteria. Mr. Young, earlier you said you referred to this as a requirement. This is criteria for deciding who, you know, what requirements or what conditions are placed on different growers.
Right.
So we would adjust the criteria based on new information that comes out, new studies that come out about the toxicity of various chemicals. We can do that.
How is it that you know that there are 73 that do cause toxicity?
That's...
Haven't there been studies that have shown that?
There are, but to a lesser degree than to the existing. One of the things that I didn't mention also is that the current monitoring that we conduct in the receiving water, and Karen can correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't have an extensive list of pesticides. So while we do have information, it's not as robust as what we have for chlorpyrifos and diazinon. And what we've done in the draft order is to include a larger suite of pesticides in the receiving water monitoring so we get a better idea of what chemicals are being found in surface water and which are causing toxicity. So this draft order also helps us to gather that new information.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to follow up on those other 73, are some of those constituents banned constituents that have been identified?
There are banned constituents that, of course, contribute to toxicity. It's actually, I think, more than 75. The ones that I'm referring to and which are indicated in the findings of the draft order are currently in use.
And in the notice of intent, is there a box there for people to list any pesticides that they're using or just whether they are using C and D?
The growers already report to the Department of Pesticide Regulation through the permitting process which chemicals they plan to use. Staff has access to that data, and we are using that data and evaluating that data. Unfortunately, that data doesn't come in a very timely manner to us, and so we have put in the notice of intent checkboxes that allow them to quickly report whether or not they're using chlorpyrifos and diazinon. It also provides a space for them to report their pesticide use permit number so staff can quickly assess which chemicals they are applying without imposing the burden upon them to report every single chemical that they're using.
Well, seems to me the issue here is just toxicity, period.
It is.
Not the individual components of it. I mean, isn't that what the standard is in the receiving waters?
It is. That is the basin plan standard.
I mean, if you started from that and worked backwards, you could simply say, you know, are you discharging anything that might be contributing to toxicity? And it seems like you're narrowly defining this criteria here.
Yes.
And so I just have an issue with that at this point, and I'll just listen to what everyone else has to say about it. But
yes, it's true. What you just said is accurate. We're narrowly defining this criteria according to specific chemicals at this point in time. The order requires toxicity sampling in receiving waters. It also says that the executive officer will order follow-up monitoring to determine what is causing that toxicity, what chemicals are causing that toxicity. And there are toxicity identification analyses that are done, standard practices to determine what chemicals are actually causing it. So that's built into the order to do that follow-up monitoring and determine what those chemicals are and where they are coming from. We can't know it ahead of time. We do the sampling, we do the analysis to determine what that is, and then we modify our approach based on those results.
But you could know ahead of time if they're using any other chemicals on the list, if you asked, instead of the C and the D. I mean, that would start to give you some information that perhaps you should be looking a little further.
Mm-hmm.
But we can go on. Lisa, you want to start your portion of this? Oh, actually, something else for Angela, if I could. Going back to the tiers, let's say I'm in tier one. How do I get out of tier one? Is there any way?
How do you get out of tier one?
Yeah, let's say I'm a farmer. No.
You don't want to be in the order.
Yeah, you don't want to be under this order at all.
Then you would eliminate your discharge.
What if you can show that the discharge is not violating any standards? Yeah, I have a discharge. It's water. And before it gets into groundwater, there's nothing in it. Before it gets off my land, there's nothing in it except water. Or it's at least meeting receiving water standards. Can I get out of the order?
Let me answer that. The water code requires that a person who's discharging waste or could discharge waste that could impact the quality of the water is not violate water quality standards but could impact the quality of the waters of the state must submit a report of waste discharge and receive waste discharge requirements or a waiver of waste discharge requirements. So just saying that I'm not violating water quality standards does not get you out of that obligation to comply with the water code. If you, in fact, do not discharge anything, then you're not obligated to submit a report of waste discharge or join this enroll in this waiver. But the fact that you may discharge something that could impact the quality of the waters of the state obligates you to comply with the water code And that's how it works.
You know, I understand that. I'm not suggesting that someone not file something, but let's say that people have filed. Let's say they have filed because they could possibly threaten water quality, but they're then able to demonstrate that their discharge is not violating any standards.
Well, the way the order is set up now is to have a tier one. If you want to have a tier zero or a tier half, you know, you could have a tier that has even lesser requirements if you choose. So if they're below some threshold, additional threshold, you know, you could ask how that could work.
Well, I mean, it's something we could talk about, but I'd like there to be, you know, some incentive, you know, for people to try to get to that, you know, level where they can demonstrate they're not having an impact on the environment. But,
well, Mr. Chair, there's obviously 7% of the community feels that, because we only have 93% enrolled in our old order. So there's 7% feel that they're in that position already.
Well, I don't know if that's wishful thinking or not. I don't know who they are or what they represent, but
well,
there is a number out there that's not.
Yeah. They may have a different opinion than that they're not discharging.
A little levity on this issue,
right.
But you know, just it brought to mind that since we're here in Watsonville, I do know that historically there were apple orchards up in the Mount Madonna area that didn't irrigate. They were all natural spring-fed irrigation. There was no water applied other than the rainfall and what springs provided to their orchards. There was no turbidity runoff. They did use chemicals to spray. So how do they fit in that criteria? I mean, there's – and I think that's kind of where Chairman Young was going. If you – say if you have a strawberry farm, I don't want to keep picking on strawberries, but I do know they use drip and also grape. If you have a small vineyard, say 100 acres, and you use drip, you have no runoff. Use some chemicals, but it's all within. You meet all the requirements. Why would you have to go through all the nosebleed of filing an application each time, each reporting time?
The notice of intent is something you do once in a five-year period, and it would describe your operation. So if you have an operation, as you're describing, that in the grower's opinion is not discharging waste, then that's what they would describe in that. And I don't think that's a great burden to describe one's operation.
Yeah, well, there was some letters from avocado farmers that gave that somewhat same description, and they wanted to know why they had to be participating in this. But I'll just bring that up.
So council has explained, if there is a discharge, then they've got to be covered.
And if they don't have any discharge, then they can prove it?
Then they would not need a permit.
Okay. Then could you explain to us, like, if you're in Tier 3 or 2, how you could move down a tier?
So the order, as with any other program or general order, specifies general criteria. And so we recognize that the criteria may not fit all operations and that some operations may legitimately not belong in a particular tier. So we included a specific condition, I believe it's condition number 17, that lists ability for a grower to document why they should be in a lower tier, and it lists out the specific information they could provide. And it's similar to other programs. For example, we evaluated what we look at in reports of waste discharge types of information. It's standard.
Well, I don't want to keep harping on this issue, but I keep going back to the criteria of Tier 3. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, if you have a farm of 1,000 acres or more, is that one of the criteria?
That's correct.
Okay.
Sorry, it's 1,000 acres or more if you grow crops that are high nitrate loading to groundwater. If you just have a 1,000-acre vineyard, you are not automatically Tier 3.
In February, I used the description, and our legal advised me that we couldn't go into that at that particular time. And I used, the Jeffries Farm. And I farm 1,000 acres. But it isn't one plot. It's 1,000 acres over the whole Salinas Valley. I'm one farm, but I farm several acres in different parts of the Salinas Valley. Some I own, some I lease. Does that constitute 1,000 acres? Would I be required to file just because I do farm? What happens if I farm 999 acres? You know, why? And so how does the collectively, you're collecting the amount of acres for one farming operation? So the Jeffries Farm operates 1,000 acres, but it's not 1,000-acre lot. It's 50 acres here, 100 acres there, and so forth. Why would I be in Tier 3 if I had 1,000 acres?
So I drafted this slide that you see here in front of you, and the draft order, the tiering system is based upon your individual operation. We heard from many commenters that we should recognize that the relative load of pollutants, and especially recognize that smaller farms may not have as significant pollutant load as a larger farm. And in terms of nitrate loading potential, I think the evidence shows that a high nitrate loading crop over a large acreage is higher risk than a high nitrate loading crop on a very small acreage. So here's an example in front of you that shows how a Tier 3 operation of greater than 1,000 acres, how the requirements would apply, because the requirements actually apply based upon your individual ranch. So in this example, there's one operation. It's 1,300 acres, and there's three different farms. The farms may be in the same watershed, or they may be in completely different watersheds. So farm number one is 800 acres lettuce. Farm number two is 200 acres of carrots. And farm number three maybe is 300 acres of grapes. I put some factors in here to help us illustrate more some specifics. So let's say the lettuce farm does have tailwater. The carrot farm is all on drip, so maybe there's no tailwater. Vineyards, of course, have very little irrigation runoff, and let's say there's no tailwater. But let's say that the vineyard is next to this creek, which is impaired for sediments and turbidity. So farm number one, because it's a high-risk nitrate loading crop, would have to evaluate their nitrate loading risk factor. If that risk factor was high, they would have to implement an irrigation nutrient management plan. Because they also have tailwater, they would have to do individual discharge monitoring for their irrigation runoff and stormwater. The 200-acre carrot farm would likely, after an evaluation of nitrate loading risk, would likely be low and therefore would not require the development and implementation of an irrigation nutrient management plan. But they have tailwater, and so they would have to conduct individual monitoring. Or I'm sorry, they don't have tailwater, so they would have to do irrigation runoff monitoring, only stormwater monitoring. This farm number three in this example is a vineyard with no tailwater, but next to the sediment or turbidity impaired creek. Because they're not a high nitrate loading ranch or farm, they wouldn't have to do the irrigation nutrient management plan, but they would have to do the water quality buffer plan or an alternative because they're next to this sediment or turbidity impaired creek. So this is an example that illustrates a Tier 3 operation, multiple farms over a large acreage, and how we attempted in the draft order to require farm-relevant conditions.
Question now. Let's look at farm number one. It is being pulled into Tier 3 simply by virtue of the fact that the owner has these other two farms, and that if you had another farm adjacent to it, everything the same, 800 acres, lettuce, tailwater, it would not have the same requirements imposed on it, right?
That is partially true, because if the adjacent acreage was Tier 2, they would still have to evaluate the nitrate loading risk, and they would still have to report total nitrogen applied, which are elements of the annual compliance form. They would not have to go through the whole process of evaluating the irrigation nutrient management plan. And essentially what we have done, and this is not to say that the smaller acreage farms don't have the potential for nitrate loading, because they do.
They do, right.
The point here in this requirement is that the smaller operations in the beginning have to conduct less requirements. And we are trying to recognize the fact that the smaller farms had several comment letters that the requirements were overly burdensome. So it's a phasing of requirements and starting with those operations that are larger and potentially have higher risk. Alternatively, we also considered
Angela,
same requirements for everybody.
Excuse me, Angela, but the risk to farm from farm number one is no different than the risk to the adjacent farm doing the exact same thing.
Right.
So that's conceptual. I just have a problem with the way this is laid out, that just by virtue of an owner collectively having a lot of land, that each of these farms isn't being evaluated independently and is being evaluated in this aggregate. So I just have an issue.
We attempted to be reasonable in applying the requirements.
I understand. I'm just pointing out what my observation is. Now let's look at farm number two, the 200 acres of carrots. Is farm number two having to do anything extra by virtue of the fact that it now happens to be owned by this individual that has over 1,000 acres? I mean, would this be simply a, could this be a Tier 1? Standing alone. Got another neighbor next door, Farm B, 200 acres of carrots, no tailwater.
It depends on if they're using chlorpyrifosfordiazinon, but it's possible.
It's possible it could be Tier 1, and it's possible it may not have to do individual monitoring. Okay. So those are two examples that I think there's maybe, I mean, it's your approach to this. I'm not saying it's not reasonable. I'm just pointing out that it's something for us to talk about.
I think it's going to cause a lot of confusion, in my estimation.
Yeah. Well, it's the fairness factor.
Well, it's fair that on top of that, but that's the reason I pointed out, if you have one operation has multiple locations, they may not collectively be one farm of 1,000
right.
acres that they're irrigating or whatever they're doing, farming at that one particular location, but might be spread all over the Salinas Valley.
Right.
And
right.
so consequently, why, you know, if one of their locations meets the Tier 3, why does the whole operation meet the Tier 3? The rest of it might be in Tier 1. And that would make a lot of difference on the type of monitoring that they'd have to report and the cost of that monitoring. So that's some of my concern. That's what I was trying to allude to in February when I started on that questioning of the farm being that size. But I think that's something the staff needs to look at and define a little bit better, and maybe the board should take a little closer look at that.
I think stated another way, The level of regulation should be commensurate with the threat. Just boil it down to that. And if you've got two farms side by side that pose the same amount of threat, I think that the level of regulation should be similar. Unless you can demonstrate, better than what I've seen so far, that it should be done any differently. So, I mean, the only rationale I can see is that you have a landowner with more than 1,000 acres that he or she has more money, possibly more revenue stream, to deal with this. But I don't know that that should be the criteria that should be used.
Before we get on to Lisa's presentation here, just to mention, staff evaluated tiering based upon individual ranches. And if you remember the figure that I showed you in the beginning, of the 1,700 operations that we have, that's more than 3,000 individual farms. And some farms have as many as 10 to 12 individual farms. And so what it does is it requires those particular operations to tier all of their farms individually and to comply with all those requirements individually. Instead, what we did was to tier versus an operation, and then when it came down to the ranch level, to apply the conditions ranch specific or farm specific. So, for example, we didn't have all of the Tier 3 operation farms within an operation have to do an irrigation management plan. We attempted to say, okay, only that condition only applies to the farm where it makes sense.
Okay. Who is next? Lisa. We'll take a break after your presentation, so I need to get some water.
Okay, well, this is the section I know you've all been waiting for.
The end, right?
Yes. Exactly. Actually, Michael will be the end. And since my last name is McCann, instead of saying good morning, I'm going to say top of the day to you on the St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
I'm going to review the public input process and summarize the outcomes of the early public input prior to us publicly distributing the draft November 2010 draft agricultural order, and briefly discuss the alternatives that were submitted and how those were considered in developing the draft 2010 order. And then I'll review some of the specific popular comments we got on that draft that led to the 2011 draft order that we're discussing today. So we've been seeking input and discussing requirements for this order for about 2.5 years, starting in fall 2008. Met with numerous stakeholders. That included several individuals, groups, at multiple events in several different forums. And through all these meetings and events, we received a lot of input, and we've attempted to respond to all of this input. And you might recall that the staff report included a table that had a long list of all the outreach events that we attended and participated in. And in addition to those, we had numerous follow-up phone conversations and meetings with individuals as outcomes of those particular events as well. So in summary, in that early period, we heard these kind of key points and key input, that we should prioritize based on water quality effects, that human health and drinking water should be the highest priority, protecting human health and drinking water, that one size does not fit all, and that the requirements should be higher for those discharging the most or most threatening water quality, and that growers need flexibility to comply. That we should be reasonable in terms of providing timeframes that are reasonable to control waste discharges and to meet water quality goals. That we should require reasonable amounts of implementation, monitoring, and reporting requirements, and that the flexibility is needed to comply with these requirements based on uniqueness of the multitude of operations. So we considered a wide range of options, and again, we gave you a lot of pages describing all those options in the staff report, and that was based on staff research, input from stakeholders, and reviewing some readily available examples that we had as well as alternatives submitted. So first of all, we used as a basis, as Michael illustrated earlier, the existing 2004 conditional waiver. We also looked back to the recommendations that we had made in our February 1st, 2010 preliminary draft order. We looked at an alternative that was submitted by OSR Enterprises, which is a farming operation in our region. Alternative submitted by the California Farm Bureau Federation in conjunction with other agricultural organizations and the county farm bureaus. And an alternative submitted by a group of environmental organizations, including the Environmental Defense Center, Monterey Coast Keeper, and others. I've lined these up in terms of the degree of regulation or requirements, which Michael also talked about in his introduction. In staff's opinion, the 2004 conditional waiver and the alternatives submitted by OSR Enterprises and the Farm Bureau Federation are similar and provide the lowest degree of regulation relative to this list. And we compared all these to develop the 2011 draft agricultural order, and this is where it falls in this list as far as the degree of regulation and requirements. We evaluated and compared all these options and alternatives to build an order that was responsive to stakeholders' recommendations while still addressing water quality problems, providing accountability, reasonableness, and flexibility. The Farm Bureau alternative and the environmental alternative contained some unique features or terms, which I want to mention briefly. The Farm Bureau proposal led staff to add the use of coalitions as an acceptable means for individual growers to comply with the order. But there were several other elements of the proposal that we found unworkable, and we did not change anything in our recommendation. One of the most unworkable elements is the monitoring and reporting as proposed in that alternative, because it did not include any indicators to show control of waste discharges, no indicators to show pollution reduction at individual farm level, no reporting on the results of groundwater monitoring, and no reporting of the results of individual discharge monitoring, which is only an option if a grower wanted to choose it anyway, but if they were to choose it, that they wouldn't be reporting any of the results of that monitoring. Equally unworkable was the absence of time schedules to show that management practices are effectively controlling discharges or reducing pollution loading, and that the milestones are inadequate. I want to elaborate on what we found inadequate about the milestones as proposed in this alternative and explain the milestones in the draft agricultural order and compare them. So the draft agricultural order includes a general condition for all dischargers to comply with water quality standards, protect beneficial uses, and prevent nuisance over time by controlling their waste discharges. It also includes specific conditions for Tier 3 dischargers to control individual dischargers of pesticides, toxic substances, sediment, and nutrients by specific dates. So, for example, the condition says they must control discharges, nutrient discharges by October 1st, 2015. Both the draft order and the Farm Bureau proposal contain milestones. And these milestones are indicators of compliance. They're not in of themselves enforceable, but they're indicators of compliance with the conditions of the order, and they give us some indication of whether we're making water quality improvements, both in discharges and in receiving waters. A side-by-side comparison of all the milestones in the Farm Bureau proposal and the draft order is contained in the staff report in Section 7 of Appendix D. I'm not going to go over all of them, but I just want to explain some of the general differences and give you one example. The milestones in the draft order apply to both receiving waters and individual discharges for Tier 3 dischargers. The Farm Bureau proposal only includes milestones for receiving waters. The milestones in the draft order for individual dischargers are indications of pollution reduction and runoff from these farms. The milestones in the order, most significantly, the draft order also includes milestones for nitrate loading to groundwater from individual farms, and there's no comparable milestone in the Farm Bureau proposal for groundwater. And most significantly, the milestones in the draft agricultural order represent greater water quality improvement over shorter timeframes. These milestones and timeframes are necessary given the severity of the pollution. They are also necessary so growers have shorter-term indicators to inform if and how they are controlling their pollution in their waste discharges, such that they can be provided the flexibility to use adaptive management in response and within the 5-year term of the order to improve their level of waste discharge. The milestones in the draft order are reasonably based on technical information that indicates fate of chemicals in the environment and known pollution control practices that have been measured to successfully achieve similar milestones as in the timeframes that's proposed in the draft agricultural order. And this information is detailed in the staff report, mainly in Chapter 3C. So I want to show you how this would relate to an actual stream, the application of these two milestones over time. In order to do that, we have to convert the Farm Bureau milestone, which is a 10% load reduction, to a concentration in order to compare directly to staff's milestone, which is the water quality standard for nitrate in drinking water of 10 milligrams per liter. So that's a concentration expression of the milestone over a 5-year time frame. So if flow stays the same, a 10% load reduction is equivalent to a 10% concentration reduction. So assume that this stream has a current nitrate concentration of 30 milligrams per liter. This is a typical surface water concentration for several waters in the lower Santa Maria River and Salinas River watershed. If the Farm Bureau proposal is achieved in this river reach, the concentration would go down by 3 milligrams per liter in 10 years for an ultimate concentration after 10 years of 27 milligrams per liter. If the draft order's milestone is achieved, the concentration will go down by 20 milligrams per liter in 5 years for a 67% reduction. Let me remind you again at this point that these milestones are indicators of progress. We don't expect a water body necessarily that's meeting 30 milligrams per liter to achieve 10 milligrams per liter in 5 years. But we do think that it's reasonable to expect tens of milligrams per liter of reduction if all of the farms contributing nitrate loading to the surface water body actually comply with all the conditions, it's reasonable to assume that 10 milligrams per liter or something in that vicinity could be achieved. And again, that's related to the evidence we have that we have water bodies where people implemented management practices and were able to achieve that level of reduction. At the rate of reduction proposed by the Farm Bureau Group, it would take about 100 years for the river to meet the 10 milligrams per liter concentration. So this is just a table expression of comparing the nitrate milestones for surface waters between the draft agricultural order and for surface waters for the Farm Bureau proposal. And I apologize, these got out of order because I meant to show you this first. Drinking water quality standard, 10 milligrams per liter over 5 years as an indicator of progress and whether we're approaching that in the draft order versus a decrease in nitrate loads from the current cooperative monitoring program sites, which are the receiving water sites in stream, of 10% in 10 years. And I just want you to note here that there's no milestones in the Farm Bureau proposal for individual discharge reductions and as well not for groundwater. Okay, moving on to the environmental alternative. The environmental alternative was submitted as a letter that expressed support for the components in the February 1st, 2010 preliminary draft order, but said the draft order ultimately should be more protective of water quality. We incorporated some of the elements of the environmental alternative in terms of monitoring requirements, increased erosion and sediment control requirements, riparian area protections, and clarifications to make it clear how one complies and compliance would be determined. Okay, we received 116 letters, comment letters, by the comment submittal date of January 3rd, 2011. And those, again, were comments on the November 2010 draft order. The comment letters themselves represent much more or many more than 116 comments and suggestions, because some of the letters were very lengthy and had multiple comments that spanned quite a broad list of topics, as well as the fact that many letters were signed by multiple organizations and or individuals. And we posted all these letters on our website, so for those who were interested should have by now been able to take a look at what some of the nature of those comments were. And I'm just going to focus on sharing a little bit of our response to some of the more common comments. The focus of the most common comments were around tiering criteria, drinking water impacts, groundwater protection, monitoring, and some legal issues. Okay, in terms of tiers and tiering criteria, some of this is actually going to speak to some of the issues that we've already talked about, so I hope it's insightful and might clear up some of our responses to some of your questions. We added proximity to public water supply wells that exceed the drinking water standard for nitrate to the tiering criteria for Tier 3 so that we'd have a parallel criterion that was protective of groundwater or spoke to the threat to groundwater quality parallel to those that we had already that were about the threat to surface water quality. Okay, we removed the size or the acreage amount relative to the use of pesticides. And this is because we agreed with comments that the size of the operation when it comes to pesticide use is not necessarily indicative of threat to water quality. And, you know, for example, that goes in part to some pesticides are more toxic than others, so a little bit has a bigger effect.
Lisa, before you go on, can you go back to the public water supply wells? And what is that? Can you give me a definition of that?
Of what a public water supply well is?
Correct. 15? Over 15.
Over 15, is that connections or people? Connection. Yeah, so that's 15 connections.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay, we replaced the term adjacent to, so there was a criteria that said if you're adjacent to a water body impaired for toxicity or pesticides, that was a qualifying criterion, and we changed that to say if you are discharging to that impaired water body rather than just adjacent to it. So there has to be the connection there. And again, this more adequately considers operations that are, in fact, actually affecting water quality and don't just happen to be nearby. So that would be regardless of their proximity to an impaired water body. So they could be farther away, but if they're discharging directly, that would qualify. We added this clarification that the executive officer can add specific pesticides as a criteria as we have new information that supports that they are causing toxicity along with chlorpyrifos and diazinon. And we added the sustainable in practice certification that Angela spoke about earlier because we got a lot of comments that a certification such as that should be allowable if it's verifiable and there's demonstrated evidence, which in the case of SIP certified with the Central Coast Vineyard team, we have evidence that those farms are having minimal to no impact on water quality. We also broaden that to say that other equivalent certifications could be submitted and the executive officer could then approve those as also qualifying criterion for Tier 1. Okay, on the topic of drinking water and conditions related to groundwater, we reduced the frequency of groundwater sampling for Tier 3 dischargers. I think it was quarterly originally, and we made it two events in the first year, so it's parallel to the requirement, the number of events for sampling, and that was in response to comments that the costs of groundwater monitoring were burdensome. We also clarified that groundwater levels are only required where existing well construction allows ease of these measurements to make it clear that we weren't intending anybody to drill a new well, change their well construction, or spend a lot of money on that in order to be able to measure wells and get some baseline information from a suite of wells on levels. And again, that responded to comments where people said they were concerned that this sounded like they had to have new wells to meet that requirement. And we had the requirement to install backflow prevention devices was originally 3 years. We made it 1 year because we received several comments that said, why allow so much time to continue a practice that threatens, if not actually affects water quality directly?
And aren't they already under some requirement to do that?
Most counties, but not all counties in our region, have ordinances that require, so that covers the gap there. Okay. We removed some parameters from being required or in the surface water receiving monitoring, such as bacteria, and this was responsive to comments, again, about costs, but also that there were some constituents that we originally had that are not don't appear to be directly discharged or affected from or related to agricultural discharges.
Was that considered from road discharge, highways? Because I know there was one or two letters that talked about if there was chemicals coming off of highways onto their waterways, would they be responsible for that cleanup?
So the removing the parameters is not responsive to that. That removing the parameters was specifically because of the mismatch of the chemicals that we were asking to be monitored in receiving water not typically being used or generated by irrigated agricultural activities.
I don't think you answered my question.
I don't think I did either, but I wanted to clarify that this response to comments did not respond to those comments.
Okay.
So if you want to restate your question, then I'd be happy to answer that.
Well,
or try.
I'll ask the question again, but somebody in the staff surely can answer it. How do we handle the discharges from roadways, highways, county roads, and so forth? Well, city streets are handled under their orders that they have. Now, where they end up is another issue, but I'm talking about, stormwater, whatever. But, you know, you take Highway 1 between here and Salinas, you've got multiple ranches along Highway 1 that there is drainage.
I believe Highway 1 would be covered on the Caltrans has a stormwater permit. Oh. So, yeah, if it's a state road, it's covered under Caltrans for stormwater runoff and any pollutants in stormwater. If it's a municipal road, it's covered by our municipal stormwater program and the municipality's obligation to control runoff from roads. If they are rural roads in rural areas that don't fit into that, there might be a gap there.
So you're saying that during the monitoring process, if I don't know if one of the constituents is benzene or any hydrocarbons are detected in that waterway, they're not responsible? Egg? That farmer's not responsible? What happens to
this?
That?
Well,
I'm not sure if I understand the question. If you're saying that pollution that runs off of Highway 101 onto a farm, who's responsible for that pollution?
Right.
And under the law, I'll practice being attorney here for a second. Both parties are responsible.
Well, let me clarify that. So if a highway like if Caltrans is subject is discharges from the highway, Caltrans has to have a stormwater permit and has to control those discharges, and they would be responsible. The farm would not become responsible for that discharge.
Well, I understand that. And I knew that would be the answer. But in all practicalities, if that constituent comes up with the monitoring and the testing of the water, it's initially going to go to the farmer. Now, is he going to have to hire an attorney to prove that this is not his or her responsibility? That's the area that I'm looking at.
I think it's an issue in every discharger that monitors, that there's of any program. They monitor, we get the information, then you evaluate the information. Is there a reason to believe that particular discharger is causing that problem? Then they would address it. But I think they've attempted, the staff has attempted to have the monitoring program specific to the kinds of chemicals that would come from farms, not things that would come from roads. And they would evaluate that, whether that leads to further management practices or any enforcement would be evaluated based on the information. It's not some automatic enforcement.
But when you look at, if you take monitoring at Salinas River, or if you take it at the Morro Coho, or if you take it at the Elkhorn Slough, or if you take it at Quail Creek, you're going to have all those involved in that. And so as a farmer, as the Jeffries Farm is saying, hey, that is my responsibility. Is that going to be accepted by the staff? Or do I have to argue somewhere down the line, or do I have to hire legal representation to argue with you and say, ain't my job?
Can I make a couple comments now that I understand where you're going better? First of all, be very clear that the constituents that we are recommending be monitored to inform compliance with the conditions of this draft order are those types of constituents that could reasonably be assumed to be loaded from agricultural discharges. If we were to find in the monitoring for this order that there are other constituents that are popping up somehow that are signals, then we would be working with growers to follow up and figure out what is the source. Additionally, in general, our CCAMP program monitors parameters beyond what's required in this draft order receiving water monitoring, exactly so that we can find parameters that are coming from anywhere that might be impairing our waters and respond to that. And my last point is we have a parallel program, as you might recall, the Total Maximum Daily Load Program, which is explicitly about following up from constituents that are impairing our surface water bodies, identifying all the sources to different reaches or streams or estuaries, and making all the responsible sources and loading for those. So irrigated agriculture would continue to be responsible for their portion of the contribution if roads or other sources are also causing similar chemicals or other different chemicals, then we would be involved in a parallel process with those dischargers about their waste discharges.
Do we have a specific language in this order that defines that?
Mr. Jeffries, I'm still confused about what is your concern.
Well, my concern is these folks are working on a very slim margin to operate their ranches. And if we start making them required for other people's responsibilities, whether it's erosion or from some other area or chemicals off of a highway that's responsible to Caltrans or the county, perhaps, then I think it puts undue financial burden on the individual farmer to make that happen.
Okay, so, and I think that
that's where, you know, clarification, and most of these folks out here, you know, they don't have legal staff on their, you know, to be paid to analyze and interpret all these rules and regulations of exactly what they're supposed to do.
Okay, and I think that the answer to the first part of your question is that the proposed order requires monitoring specific to what is might come off of a farm. Right, and the monitoring and reporting program, if a farmer says that doesn't fit our farm, they can request the executive officer to revise and reduce the monitoring. But basically, it's not requiring people to monitor for things that aren't expected to be on farms. And then there's no suddenly jump to, oh, we're going to enforce against you because the water body has this in it. The non-point source policy and the waiver requires that then you evaluate that information. Are my management practices working to control the discharges from my farm, not from somebody else's farm, not from the roads, not from whatever? So it's specific to that. And the waiver law requires that there be monitoring to evaluate the effectiveness of complying with the terms. So there needs to be some monitoring and follow-up, but it's not suddenly we're going to do enforcement, you have to go hire an attorney, and that isn't triggered by the way the order is written.
Okay, but I just want to make sure that there's specific information in that order that says what you just said.
If I could add a comment, Mr. Jeffries, the examples you were giving of major water bodies, I think you mentioned Elkhorn Slough and Quail Creek and so forth, those water bodies are in the receiving water are measured currently through the cooperative monitoring program,
right.
And they're at confluence points. So that is more watershed scale monitoring, which isn't just affected by agriculture. So that's what we have going now already with the existing order, and will continue with the proposal that we have here. So we recognize that there are going to be signals in that data, mineral results, for example, where some of the elevations in certain watersheds are from what comes out of the natural formations, from the soil and the rock that are in those watersheds. So, and in other cases, it may be affected by, as you say, runoff from roads. We have coordination with the City of Salinas Municipal Stormwater Program, where we have upgradient, downgradient monitoring. And we recognize that will pick up different signals depending on what's draining to those points. So we've been dealing with that already with the cooperative monitoring program.
Well, I gave a demonstration of large water bodies, but I also used the demonstration of Highway 1. And you got several fields of artichokes along Highway 1, as well as strawberry fields, and Brussels sprouts and a number of other crops that you look at between here and Salinas. And they're all adjacent to a state highway or a county highway. Those are not large water bodies that I'm talking about, but you would have runoff on those particular farms. And if that chemical is commingled with their testing, I just want to make sure that those folks are not responsible for that runoff. That's
right.
Where I'm going with.
And if any of those farms, and that's a big if, were required to do individual runoff monitoring from their farm, and one of the common problematic constituents from roadways is copper from brake linings, the growers would not be required to analyze for copper. Another one is total petroleum
asbestos.
Hydrocarbons from oil and grease.
Okay.
They're not required to monitor for that. So it wouldn't even show up. It wouldn't be an issue.
Okay.
I'm going to start here on the second bullet.
Why don't we just take
you need a break? You can't go 8 hours nonstop? That's okay. We'll take a 15-minute break.
Okay.
Is that right?
I was just going to say, Lisa may have only a few.